And the views and opinions expressed on Gaza Corner are those of mine, Dori Stein, and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of KALW, a public media. I'm going to start with a follow-up to the April 5th Gaza Corner. On April 5th, I reported on Israel's March 23rd close-range execution of 15 Palestinian aid workers, including Red Crescent paramedics, first responders, and UN staff. It took almost 2 weeks for the bodies and the vehicles to be discovered. They had been buried in a big sand pit. The day after my Gaza Corner report, on April 6th, the New York Times published an article, and that article was titled, "Eyewitnesses Recount Deadly Israeli Attack on Medics in Gaza." And those eyewitnesses were Dr. Saeed al-Bardawil, a 55-year-old physician, and his 12-year-old son, Mohammed. They were on their way to go fishing when they were detained by Israeli soldiers the day of the massacre. And they were interviewed by the New York Times for its investigation into the massacre. And again, they appear in the April 6th story, so they were prominent eyewitnesses to the massacre or execution of 15 aid workers at close range. A second round of testimonies were scheduled for 12-year-old Mohammed to assist in an international commission on war crimes, with testimonies and evidence submitted to the UN office and the South African legal team at the International Court of Justice. He's not going to be at the hearing. And what I'm about to tell you, as far as I know, has not been reported in the New York Times. I did a search for Mohammed al-Bardawil, and it only came up with that one article, "Eyewitnesses Recount Deadly Israeli Attack on Medics in Gaza." But what happened, and I discovered, was via a tweet. On X on May 13th, a man by the name of Malachi Brown, who is an employee of the New York Times, his description reads, "Visual Investigations at New York Times, Pulitzer Team for International Reporting 2020 and 2023. He published a tweet, and apparently the New York Times, at this point anyway, has not seen fit to do the same. I'll read his tweet. "Mohammed al-Bardawil, a young witness to the March 23rd attack on medics in Gaza, was killed on Saturday, which was May 10th, when an Israeli gunboat fired on Rafah Beach. His father, Saeed, asked our colleague, Bilal Abu Yazan, for a photo of his son when he interviewed them together for our report. And I can't post the photo on the playlist because I don't have the rights to, but it's a touching photo on the beach of his father and the 12-year-old who was killed before he was able to provide further eyewitness testimony. The week of May 15th is a tradition on Gaza Corner to commemorate the Nakba, which coincides with Israeli Jews celebrating its day of independence. The Nakba, translated into English, the catastrophe, marks 77 years of dispossession and loss of its homeland. I don't view the Nakba as a one-time event. As Jonathan Kutab wrote, quote, "Palestinians speak of the ongoing Nakba, whereby the destruction of their national existence, the prevention of their return, the suppression of their identity, and the expansion of Jewish settlements has been necessary for the success of the Zionist project to establish a Jewish state atop Palestinian lands. It has been a continuous act. This is no longer the quote, but this is me speaking. It's been continuous. Continuous acts of killing, ethnic cleansing, and land theft that now threatens to empty all of historic Palestine of Palestinians if the current Israeli government and Trump has their way. I want to play for you 2 minutes of a much longer speech that Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib made on the commemoration day of the Nakba on May 15th. She did it in Congress. In the video that I saw online, and there's a link of her speaking, it's an Instagram link, and the only person that you can see anywhere behind her is Cori Bush, who supports her very much. I'm not sure how many people even were there, but she spoke in Congress, and I'd like you to hear what she had to say. She is Palestinian American, and this is the voice of Rashida Tlaib. As I say, I edited it, so it's about 2 minutes.
Today we are witnessing a genocide in Gaza. So many human rights organizations, advocacy groups, NGOs, folks on medical mission have confirmed the campaign to erase Palestinians from existence is happening right now, live streamed for all of us to see, while the world sits and does nothing. Palestinians were right. The Nakba never ended. Across Gaza, the medical system has been deliberately destroyed. The Israeli government is using starvation as a weapon of war, which is a war crime. The thousands of trucks carrying food and life-saving aid sit blocked at the border while Palestinian families starve. Instead of agreeing to a ceasefire, war criminal Netanyahu is now preparing a full-scale assault to ethnically cleanse and forcibly expel the entire Palestinian population from Gaza and to flatten and permanently occupy the land. This was always their plan. He said it himself. Israeli forces have killed more than 52,000 Palestinians, and nearly 70% of them were women and children. Babies who did not live to see their first birthday. There are thousands more who are dismembered, unrecognizable, burned alive, buried beneath the rubble, and presumed dead. Nearly 1.9 Palestinians have been displaced once again. Each year, our country sends billions of dollars to maintain this apartheid state and support the ongoing ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. Our country is complicit, Mr. Speaker, because with our nation is funding this genocide. The Israeli government will not stop until we place an arms embargo. Majority of Americans support it. We must save lives, no matter faith or ethnicity. A child is a child. My city's only crime in the eyes of the Israeli apartheid government was that she was born Palestinian. And Mr. Speaker, it kills me inside that she took her last breath without being truly free. I pray that the ongoing Nakba against the Palestinians will end. And one day they will be free.
At that time, it was Cori Bush who was trying to console Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib. Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib also presented a resolution. I'll only read a very little bit of it. The resolution is recognizing the ongoing Nakba and Palestinian refugees' rights. I'll get to toward the end of it. She says, whereas the Nakba refers not only to a historical event, but to an ongoing process of Israel's expropriation of Palestinian land and its dispossession of the Palestinian people that continues to this day. Whereas the apartheid government of Israel is committing a genocide against the Palestinian people. whereas the establishment and expansion of hundreds of illegal settlements and outposts in the occupied Palestinian West Bank, in which approximately 737,000 Israelis reside as of 2023, is another form of ethnic cleansing used to perpetuate the Nakba. Whereas the United States is complicit in Israel's ongoing Nakba. And then she presents a number of points that she would hope could be put into practice, including ensuring that the United States ends its complicity in Israel's ongoing Nakba against the Palestinian people. There's a link to this resolution at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist at tangents.com. Thanks, Harry, for getting those links up as quickly as you could. Palestinians have been subject to this ongoing Nakba, and it's not from May 15th, 1948. I want to take a little bit of time to provide history of the Nakba, because it did not begin, nor did it end, on May 15th, 1948. As I say, there are links. You can get more in depth to learn about this at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. The roots of the Nakba stem from the emergence of Zionism as a political ideology in the late 19th century in Eastern Europe. The ideology is based on the belief that Jews are a race that deserve their own state. I remember very clearly in Hebrew school, and I was a Reformed Jew, and I think I started in like third grade, maybe fourth grade. And I was taught Palestine was a, quote, a land without a people for a people without a land. So perfect for the Jews to take over. And that Palestine was a desert until the Jews transformed it into the, quote, land of milk and honey, unquote. I didn't learn until years later that these were complete falsehoods, false narratives that took root. Before the start of the British Mandate, which was 1920 to 1947, on November 2nd, 1917, the British issued the Balfour Declaration promising to help, quote, the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. The Balfour Pledge is generally regarded as one of the main catalysts of the Nakba. And while researching tonight's Gaza Corner, I came across a United Nations document called The Palestine Question. It is linked at the Gaza Corner section. It excerpts a report issued in 1930 by a commission appointed with the approval of the League of Nations, which was the forerunner of the United Nations. Quoting from this 1930 report, the vast majority of the indigenous people of Palestine counted for little. Their land has been promised to another people by a foreign government, which at that time held no sovereign rights over Palestine. Citing these factors, several authorities have asserted that the Balfour Declaration had no binding or legal effect beyond being a statement of the intentions of one government. Zionists viewed the Balfour Declaration as evidence their goal of a Jewish state would be realized, and European Jews began arriving in large numbers well before the start of World War II. In percentage terms, the Jewish population rose from about 10% in 1919, up to 17% in 1929, to nearly 30% in 1939. In 1931, a British Royal Commission headed by Lord Peel commented, quote, the forcible conversion of Palestine into a Jewish state against the will of the Arabs would clearly violate the spirit and intention of the mandate system. It would mean that national self-determination had been withheld when the Arabs were a majority in Palestine and only conceded when the Jews were in a majority, unquote. In the 11 years leading up to the creation of the State of Israel in May 1948, Zionist terror groups, including Haganah, Lehi, and Irgun, directed their attacks against the British, who governed Palestine, and against the Palestinian indigenous population to create conditions for ethnic cleansing. The attacks helped expedite the end of the British mandate and succeeded at ethnically cleansing Palestinians from their indigenous homeland. In early 1947, the British declared it would be handing over the disaster it had created in Palestine to the United Nations. The UN, the de facto successor of the defunct League of Nations, was only 2 years old and then charged with trying to resolve the brewing Palestine catastrophe. On November 29, 1947, the UN adopted Resolution 181 recommending the partition of Palestine into Jewish and Arab states. The partition plan gave about 55% of the land of historic Palestine to the Jewish state and only 42% to a Palestinian state. Jerusalem would be under international administration. I say only 42% because at the time, Palestinians comprised about 67% of the population of Palestine. And the 33% who were Jewish, many had just recently arrived from Europe. Jews only owned about 6% of the land in 1947. Yet the Jews were allocated more than half the area of historic Palestine under the partition plan. Jews were given many of the main cities with Palestinian Arab majorities and the very important coastline running from Haifa to Jaffa. The proposed Palestinian state would be deprived of key agricultural lands and seaports, which led the Palestinians to reject the proposal. Shortly following the UN Resolution 181, war broke out. Jordanian academic and longtime professor at Columbia University, Joseph Massad, wrote, quote, "The UN could not decide to partition what it had no authority to partition, much less do so without the consultation, let alone the consent of the people of Palestine." The vote, and this is very important, occurred at a time when a large number of countries were still, and particularly in Africa, Asia, Latin America, were still under the control of European colonial powers. They were not independent yet. The vote itself passed with 33 countries in favor of partition, 13 against, and 10 abstaining. It was not a global vote. So you've got 33 and 13 and 10 is 56. Out of the 56 total votes, only four African countries were represented: Liberia, Ethiopia, South Africa, and Egypt. Only four. Today, there are 54 countries in Africa, independent countries, and 195 independent countries in the world. If the world had been sufficiently decolonialized by November 1947, the partition plan would never, ever have passed. And who knows if Israel would have even become a country. Prior to Israel's creation on May 15, 1948, the date Palestinians commemorate the Nakba, half of the total number of Palestinian refugees had already been forcefully expelled from their homeland. Zionist paramilitary groups committed numerous massacres against the Palestinians, including the Deir Yassin massacre on April 9th, 1948, About 110 Palestinian men, women, and children were slaughtered. These massacres occurred in less than 6 months from the time the UN partition plan was passed until Israel's independence, May 15, 1948. Within those 6 months, Zionist terrorist groups had already forcibly expelled about 440,000 Palestinians from 220 villages. By 1948, the Jews already had an army that was formed out of the armed paramilitary groups trained and created to fight side by side with the British in World War II. The British allowed the Jews to establish self-governing institutions, such as the Jewish Agency, to prepare themselves for a state when it came to it, but they did not allow the Palestinians. The Palestinians were forbidden from doing so, paving the way for ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Between 1947 and 1949, close to 800,000 Palestinians from an overall population of 1.9 million were made into refugees. Zionist militants had taken more than 78% of historic Palestine by 1949. They ethnically cleansed and destroyed in total about 530 villages and cities, killed roughly 15,000 Palestinians, committed more than 70 massacres. And ironically, one of the founding principles of the United Nations is respect for the principle of self-determination of people. This was recognized internationally at the end of the First World War and was extended to other Arab territories placed under mandates. However, the principle in effect was not applied to the British mandate in Palestine. In December 1948, the UN General Assembly passed Resolution 194, calling for the newly created State of Israel to allow Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. They're still waiting. Israel has never allowed a Palestinian to return to their home. Many Palestinians still keep the key to their front door that's been passed on from generations. They keep the key in the dream that one day they can return. In June 1967, Israel conquered the remaining 22% of historic Palestine, comprising of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. They also conquered Syria's Golan Heights, and this year, conquered all of it after the fall of Assad, and also in 1967 occupied the Sinai Peninsula, which was returned in a peace deal with Egypt. If you fast forward to today, Israel, with the backing of the United States, appears determined to eliminate all Palestinians from historic Palestine by any and all means necessary so that only Jews can live from the river to the sea. Former UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights Andrew Gilmore said that we are witnessing, quote, probably the highest kill rate of any military since the Rwandan genocide of 1994. The Times of Israel reported yesterday, May 16th, that the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, says it has launched the first stages of its major offensive in the Gaza Strip, dubbed Gidon's Chariots. According to Israeli officials, the Gidon's Chariots offensive would see the IDF, quote-unquote, conquering Gaza and retaining the territory. There's an in-depth report by the excellent Israeli news outlet 972 Mag. 972 Mag's Meron Rappaport and Oren Ziv, in partnership with Local Call, published a detailed work titled Render It Unusable, Israel's Mission of Total Urban Destruction. It's linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. It's subtitled, While airstrikes account for mass casualties, bulldozers and explosives are flattening Gaza from the ground. What soldiers say is a systemic campaign to make the strip unlivable. This is what 972 and local calls joint investigation has revealed. It also says the systemic destruction of residential buildings and public structures has become a central part of the Israeli army's operations and in many cases, the primary objective. If Gazans don't die from bombs, starvation, disease, with virtually no access to health care, Donald Trump is still intent on moving all Gazan survivors out of Gaza. He said it back in February about making Gaza the Riviera of the Middle East, and he's recently doubled down. On Thursday, May 15th, Trump said Gaza should be made into a quote-unquote freedom zone, a freedom zone, reminiscent, as I said, of his plan that he mentioned back in February. Quoting Trump, "Gaza has been a territory of death and destruction for many years. I have concepts for Gaza that I think are very good. Make it a freedom zone. Let the United States get involved and make it just a freedom zone. There's practically no building standing. It's not like you're trying to save something." The words of our president, or at least my president, Donald Trump. NBC, of all news outlets, broke the latest ethnic cleansing plan just the other day. The Trump administration is working on a plan to permanently relocate up to 1 million Palestinians, that's half the population, from Gaza to Libya. According to NBC, they spoke with five people with knowledge of the effort. The plan is under serious enough consideration that the administration has discussed it with Libya's leadership. In exchange for the resettling of Palestinians, the Trump administration would potentially release to Libya billions of dollars of funds that the U.S. froze more than a decade ago. The State Department and the National Security Council did not respond to multiple requests for comment before NBC published its article. But after publication, a spokesperson told NBC News, but that spokesperson is anonymous, said these reports are untrue. Quote, "The situation on the ground is untenable for such a plan. Such a plan was not discussed and makes no sense," the spokesperson said. A senior Hamas official, Bassem Naim, said that Hamas was not aware of any discussions about moving Palestinians to Libya. Quote, "Palestinians are very rooted in their homeland, very strongly committed to the homeland, and they are ready to fight up to the end and to sacrifice anything to defend their land, their homeland, their families, and the future of their children." And in response to questions from NBC, he went on to say, "Palestinians are exclusively the only party who have the right to decide for the Palestinians, including Gaza and Gazans, what to do and what not to do." NBC tried to reach representatives of the Israeli government. They declined to comment. Libya has been plagued by extreme instability and warring political factions throughout the nearly 14 years since a civil war broke out in Libya after its longtime dictator, Muammar Gaddafi, was toppled, with the U.S. playing the primary role. The CIA's most recent publicly available estimate of Libya's current population is about 7.36 million. So in terms of population, Libya absorbing 1 million people would be the equivalent to the U.S. taking in about 46 million. Quote, this is Trump talking about Gaza. He says, "We're going to take over that piece, develop it, and create thousands and thousands of jobs, and it will be something the entire Middle East can be proud of." But to achieve this goal, Trump has said Palestinians would have to be permanently resettled elsewhere. And he said he would find, quote, a beautiful area to resettle people permanently in nice homes where they can be happy and not be shot, not be killed, not be knifed to death like what's happening in Gaza. I think it should be a location that's going to make people happy. Those are the exact words of Donald Trump. Does this sound like a happy place? This is the description of Libya by the State Department. It currently advises Americans not to travel to Libya, quote, due to crime, terrorism, unexploded landmines, civil unrest, kidnapping, and armed conflict. Other countries previously rumored for Palestinians to be resettled in, Albania, Indonesia, war-ravaged Sudan, Somalia, Somaliland, and even now, along with Libya, the most recent one is Syria. Now Syria is part of the rumor mill. I'm guessing Trump may lean on Syria in return for the lifting of sanctions. Trump loves quid pro quos. But I guess I could never imagine this, but now I can imagine it. But I just can't believe it could happen.